Welcome to the Best of Science World, featuring some of the most interesting conversations we've had on our program over the past several months. Today we'll hear how our risk for having a heart attack or stroke at some time in our life is a lot higher than thought. We'll learn how researchers at Cornell University have successfully hidden a moment in time. Hear how a student, a doctoral candidate, and a professor created a Braille writer from a tablet computer. And we'll talk with a man who has been the chief scientist for NASA's Voyager spacecraft program since the Voyager was launched over 34 years ago. That's all coming up in this special edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. What do you think are your chances for having a heart attack or stroke sometime in your lifetime? Findings from a recent study have revealed some sobering statistics. According to the study, even if your doctor tells you now that you are at a low risk of having a cardiac incident in the short term, you still could have a high risk of a heart attack or stroke over the long term if you have several risk factors such as high blood pressure or if you smoke. Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones from the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine headed up the study, and he shares some of its key findings. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, you looked at a person's risk factors for developing the chances of having a heart attack or stroke. What are these risk factors?
Well, we were able to study the largest study pooling data from 18 different community-based samples of Americans and over 250,000 African-American and white people across the adult age spectrum. And what we found was that regardless of your age, your sex, your race, or when you were born, what decade you were born in, the risks for developing cardiovascular disease during your lifespan are incredibly high. For example, if you're a 45-year-old man with two or more major risk factors like hypertension or cholesterol, diabetes, or smoking, the chances that you'll have a major heart attack or stroke during your remaining lifespan are 50%. The good news, though, is that if you make it to age 45 with all of those risk factor levels optimal, the risk is only 1.4%. So, again, regardless of who you are, these traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease really dictate a huge spectrum of risk. So the better those levels are, the better you'll do.
So what do you consider to be an optimal risk factor profile?
Well, you certainly want to keep your cholesterol levels, your total cholesterol levels, under 200, your blood pressure less than 120 on the top, over less than 80 on the bottom. Don't develop diabetes, and for goodness sake, don't ever start smoking. And if you are smoking, it's never too late to stop.
Now, regarding the actual study, Dr. Lloyd-Jones, who did you study, how many were involved, how long of a period of time was involved, and how often were risk factors measured?
So we were able to look at data from 18 different studies that have been conducted across the United States over the last 50 years and included over 250,000 people, white and black men and women. In many of these studies, they had their risk factors measured at multiple times across their lifespan. So we looked at it from the point of view of, well, if you're a 45-year-old man, what's your remaining lifetime risk or chance of having a major cardiovascular event? Or if you're a 55-year-old woman or a 65-year-old man or woman and so on. And the results were remarkably consistent regardless of age, sex, race, or what decade you were born in. So these core risk factors of blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, and smoking really determine all of your risk for developing cardiovascular disease, regardless of who you are, what you look like, or where you live.
Can you share some of the important findings of your study?
Sure. I think the most important good news here is that if you can make it into middle age with optimal levels of blood pressure, cholesterol, not having diabetes, and not smoking, the chances that you'll develop cardiovascular disease during your remaining lifespan are tiny, less than 5%. And that also means you're going to live 5 to 10 years longer than people who have those risk factors. So if you're a young adult, it's really important to be following lifestyles that will help you keep those risk factors optimal, and then you can essentially abolish your chance of developing cardiovascular disease during the remainder of your life. The other piece of this, though, I think is if you're in middle age and you do have some risk factors, it's critically important to get with your doctor, know your numbers, and control your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and your diabetes risks as closely as you can, because it's never too late to do that and at least chop off some of that elevated risk that we see in this study.
If these risk factors are controlled, how does that affect the odds of getting a heart attack or stroke?
Well, we know from a number of very large clinical trials that we have extremely effective medications, particularly targeting cholesterol and blood pressure. And if you are reliable about taking those when they're prescribed by your doctor and you lower your cholesterol or your blood pressure, you can reduce the risks of heart attacks and strokes by anywhere from 30 to 50%. You can't completely reduce that risk. There's a price to pay for having developed the risk factors, but you can certainly modify it substantially, and particularly when you partner medication with lifestyle changes, like reducing sodium in your diet and losing weight if you need to. I think that, you know, cardiovascular disease, we know it's the number one killer of Americans, but I think what's also important to focus on is that this disease doesn't only kill people, it alters people's lives dramatically, tremendously affects quality of life, particularly after a stroke. It dramatically increases a person's medical costs. So everything we can do to prevent the development of those risk factors in the first place really helps keep the horse in the barn and keep this under control.
That was Dr. Donald Lloyd-Jones from the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. Thanks for listening to the Best of Science World. Today we're featuring a few of the best one-on-one conversations we've had recently with researchers, scientists, innovators, and other newsmakers. If you have a topic that you would like us to cover on our program, or would like to hear an interview with one of your favorite science-based personalities, let us know. You can do so either by sending us an email to science@voanews.com or by visiting our webpage and blog. The web address is voanews.com/science. If you're a fan of the Harry Potter series of books and movies, you're probably familiar with the invisibility cloak, a piece of clothing that turns whatever it covers invisible. In another case of life imitating art, researchers from Cornell University may be on to developing a real invisibility cloak. But rather than making a physical object invisible, Dr. Alexander Gaeta and his colleagues recently hid a moment in time, creating what they called a temporal or time-related cloak. Dr. Alexander Gaeta talks about the development of the temporal cloak and how he and his team were able to mask a moment in time. While other researchers are experimenting with and having some success with cloaking actual physical objects, your team was able to cloak a moment in time. How much time are we talking about?
It was about 50 trillionths of a second.
Could you help us understand how this happened?
What we're doing is, you know, the experiments that have been sort of hiding or cloaking objects in space, what they do is they basically bend the light rays in such a way that it appears when you're looking past the object that the rays were never bent. In some sense, we're doing the same thing, but we're doing in the time domain. That is, we light that is shining on the object, what we do is we split that light beam in time into two parts, and we slow down the back part, and we speed up the front part, and then all of a sudden there's a gap in the light beam. And so anything that passes through that gap, anything that occurs in the gap that the light beam would have interacted with, that would have told us that something had happened, will not occur. And then what we do afterwards is then we put the light beam back together by speeding up the back part, slowing down the front part so they sort of the light beam reconnects, and that's the end.
So in other words, you accomplished this without interfering with the space-time continuum itself, but just by working with the light.
That's all we're doing, is we're working with the light beam. It really, in some sense, similar to what they do in the spatial cloaking, we're just doing things in the time domain, but certainly time is the same. It's not changing. We're not manipulating time. We're really manipulating light.
How do you see this from a practical application? How do you see this development working in a practical environment?
In long term, you know, far into the future, the idea of maybe hiding or cloaking objects in space and time could be useful. So that was long-term goals. But in the short term, I could see that there could be applications, for example, in data transmission. You know, for example, our phone call right now is that data transmission on an optical fiber, and these optical fibers carry enormous amounts of data, and normally you would never want to interrupt that flow of data. This approach or this technology would allow you, for example, if you needed to put in an emergency message within that data stream, you could basically create this gap, put in your emergency message, transmit it, and then take it out, and then put the data stream back together without ever interrupting it or disturbing it.
Professor, one of the tools I read about, one of the tools your team created to make this accomplishment is called a time lens. Can you tell us a little bit about this device and what it does?
Yeah, I think, you know, just like real beams of light get focused by lenses, that is, you know, you bring in a light beam and it focuses it down to nearly a point, these time lenses do similar things, but they do it in the time domain. That is, if you came in with, let's say, a light pulse or some kind of temporal profile, what the time lens can do effectively is focus it in space or defocus it, just like ordinary lenses. So it actually can focus in time or defocus in time. So you could compress the beam or you could expand the beam, just like an ordinary lens, but you're doing it in the time domain.
I understand, Professor, that the inspiration for your experiment in which you were able to cloak time came from something called a history editor. And while I suppose that, and I've heard your experiment being referred to as a history editor, so what is a history editor and how close were you to coming up with such a device?
We all scientists try to come up with terminology that might make it more accessible to, you know, to the non-experts. I'm not sure we're editing history, but, you know, we're editing it, why don't we say, because, you know, normally the way we detect things is one of the most prominent ways of doing it is to shine light on them. And because then that gives you, that tells you something, that there's an object there or something happened, because what happens is it changes the light beam, it scatters light or it changes something about it. And what we did is manipulate the light so that it never actually sees that anything occurred. And so in that sense, you could maybe call it a history editor, though I would think more it's really what we're doing is really just manipulating the light. We're not changing anything about history. We're just changing how you would have observed it.
I'm curious, Professor, is the experiment still on? In other words, are you working to expand the amount of time that you can cloak?
We are. We're working on that, and certainly working on other perhaps practical aspects. You know, the technology that we used to demonstrate this cloaking device, we have used for a number of other applications as well. And so there are a lot of different ways in which we can really manipulate light. And this experiment of cloaking is just really a demonstration of really the very unusual ways in which we can control light and really control its properties.
That was Dr. Alexander Gaeta from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. An undergrad student, a doctoral candidate, and their professor have teamed up to develop an inexpensive and versatile tablet computer for writing Braille, the method the blind use for reading and writing. Team member Sohan Dharmaraja says that developing the Braille writer wasn't even their original goal. He tells us about how the writer was developed and what the team had in mind originally.
Our idea was to do a Braille OCR type reader. And the way it would work would be people would use the cameras on these smart devices to take a picture of a Braille page or a Braille text, and it would convert it to either text or audio or just some other useful format for the user. And it kind of came out during discussions between ourselves and between the Stanford Office of Accessible Education that there's currently no real consensus on how people who are visually impaired take notes. You know, you're providing a basic level of functionality at this point that they didn't have. So it was kind of natural that we drifted in that direction.
Sohan, can you tell us what went into developing this device to help the visually impaired?
In some sense, we were just thinking about it. You know, with today's technology, there's so much that's afforded to people with sight, you know, and with all these touch-based advancements that have happened in the last couple of years, it was kind of silly that just because you couldn't see, you couldn't use your hands to take notes. Unless you had one of those super expensive $6,000 Braille note takers that most people still carry today. It's physical, it serves only one purpose, they're very expensive, and there's this whole other range of drawbacks that come with devices like this. So we thought we can really make a contribution in this area, replace some of these obsolete technologies.
So how does it work?
The way the solution works, this is a piece of software that runs on these touchscreen devices. And to use it, you simply position your hands over the touchscreen. You touch your 8 typing fingers, which you would use to type with the physical note taker, to the screen just once. And once you do that, the keyboard, this virtual keyboard, is built beneath your fingers based on your touch location. Now, the software takes care of optimizing the button locations, button sizes, so as to improve your typing efficiency. And should you ever lose your orientation or you'd like to stop and, you know, get a drink of water, it's as easy as just putting your hands back over the screen and just touching your fingers once to the surface and you're ready to go again. And what's very nice about this solution is that there's no additional knowledge required. Anybody who can type Braille should be able to use this immediately, which is a very nice aspect. So what we have is almost analogous. The 8 buttons correspond to the exact same 8 buttons you would see on the physical note taker. And the software knows, after you calibrate it, after you do that 8-finger touch just once, the 8 buttons are on the screen. Even though we don't expect the user to see the button, the user is able to hit those buttons because the buttons are built right beneath the fingers. The dynamic keyboard that allows people to type, because, you know, if the screen is perfectly flat, you know, you have no reason to expect the user to be able to find anything on the screen. So this overcomes that. And the other nice thing is you can use this tablet in any orientation. You can put it on a table. You could suspend it from your neck. You can use this in so many different orientations. It's very, very flexible. The button sizes are built dynamically. The button locations are built dynamically. So it's a very, very flexible keyboard.
So, Hung, what kind of confirmation or response do the users get when they're interacting with this device?
So we have a couple of feedback mechanisms in place. As soon as that calibration routine, which by calibration I mean that 8-finger touch to the screen just once, when that routine occurs, we give an audio and vibrational confirmation. We say the keyboard has been calibrated and the device vibrates just a little. So the user knows that the keyboard has been rebuilt underneath his fingers. There are other mechanisms in place to allow the user to interact with the menus, which are menu options which are available wherever he or she is typing. And the way that happens is a simple shake of the device. By shaking the device, the menu is initiated, and the user can interact with the menu options by sliding their finger over the screen and simply releasing their finger when they hit the menu option they want.
How is what the user just typed on the unit played back or revealed?
With the accessibility options that are provided with the tablet, they have screen readers, which we use to convey whatever has been typed back to the user. This comes with the tablet. Apple and these Android devices have these voiceover or a screen reader that's provided to them. So you have all the advanced features that come anyway with the tablet. We don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? So when we were building this product, we were fortunate enough to have a couple of beta testers to work with. And they were blind, and they used the tablet, and they were able to type blazing fast with this. I mean, faster than I type, and I think I type at a reasonable speed. So this was very nice to see.
So what's the status of this project at this point?
We're still working on a lot of things, and we're exploring the delivery options, the best delivery option to get this into the hands of the people who need it the most. There's really not too much I can say beyond that, but we're honestly doing everything we can to just get this out there as efficiently and as best as possible.
That was Sohan Dharmaraja from Stanford University in Stanford, California. The world we live in today is constantly changing with new innovations in science, health, and technology taking place all of the time. To keep up with these changes and hear about the latest in scientific research, medical discoveries, and technological advancements, be sure to listen to VOA's Science World every Saturday and Sunday. You can hear us either on your radio or on the Internet at voanews.com/science. The Voyager 1 spacecraft, launched more than 34 years ago, still sends valuable data back to Earth. It has become the most distant human-made object in space and is now in the region between our solar system and interstellar space. Did you notice that I said still sends valuable data back to Earth? Voyager's original mission, consisting of 2 unmanned spacecraft called Voyager 1 and 2, was to explore our solar system's great outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. But now it has gone much further than that. Dr. Edward Stone has been the project scientist for the Voyager program from 1972 until the present. Dr. Stone tells us about the Voyager program and its legacy. Dr. Stone, can you first take us back to 1977 and give us a little bit of an overview of the Voyager mission?
Voyager, there were two Voyager spacecraft launched in 1977. That's a very special year. Every 176 years, the giant outer planets are lined up so that one spacecraft can fly by all four, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. So we launched two of them, hoping at least one would get to Saturn and perhaps continue the journey. And so far, that journey has continued now for over 34 years.
Dr. Stone, I remember that the late Dr. Carl Sagan once talked the administrators at NASA to turn the camera of one of the Voyager spacecraft around to take a family photo of the solar system, Dr. Sagan's pale blue dot picture. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
We had looked at this idea of actually looking back at the solar system and decided that after Voyager 2 had flown by Neptune in 1989, that before we finally turned the cameras off, on both spacecraft, but on Voyager 1 in particular, which was by that time beyond Neptune's orbit, and could look back and for the first time observe the solar system from outside of the solar system, if you like. And so that's exactly what we did on February 14th of 1990, before we finally turned off all the cameras.
Something I've always been curious about ever since the Voyager mission began, and I'm sure you've probably heard this question thousands of times since 1977, but how does JPL manage to protect these relatively tiny spacecraft on such a long voyage and so far from Earth, from asteroids, rocks, and other hazards of space?
Well, certainly the question of hazard was an important one, and the Pioneer 10 and 11 revealed that the asteroid belt itself was not a hazard. It was basically undetectable. Space is empty, really, but it does become a serious challenge when you fly near planets, because planets can have very intense radiation environments, trapped particles in their magnetic field, and Jupiter was our most serious challenge from a radiation point of view, very intense radiation environment. But the Voyager spacecraft were designed to take it and manage to survive, and that meant we had a very long life spacecraft.
So where are Voyager 1 and 2 now? Are we still getting data from the spacecraft, and if so, what are we learning from them?
They transmit 24 hours a day, and we use the large antennas we have at three places on the Earth called the Deep Space Network to listen every day for about 10 hours per spacecraft. And what they're telling us, they're observing what the magnetic field is like out there. If this is the magnetic field from the sun that's been carried out by a million-mile-per-hour solar wind. And so we measure that magnetic field and its strength and its direction. We measure the speed of the wind, which is now slowing down, and we are now approaching the contact with interstellar space itself. So we measure the winds, we measure the very high-energy particles, some of which come from inside our heliosphere, this bubble around the sun, some of which come from outside, galactic cosmic rays.
And finally, Dr. Stone, how about sharing a few of your thoughts regarding the legacy of the Voyager mission?
Well, Voyager really revealed, continues to reveal, that what's out there is much more diverse than we could have imagined. So time after time, we found surprising discoveries, which really changed our view of the solar system. That continues today as we approach interstellar space. We're learning that our models of how our sun interacts with what's outside, although reasonably detailed, we're still not accurate to the level that we're now observing, and we're discovering new things all the time about this interaction of our sun with what's outside.
That was Dr. Edward Stone, project scientist for NASA's Voyager program since 1972. That's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed the best of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. That's voanews.com/science. Now, along with program information, we've got stories, links, and much more for you. So stop by and visit us on the Internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. We'll be back next Saturday and Sunday to bring you the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.